Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
Kia ora, and welcome to this Books and Beyond We Read Auckland special. This is your host, Alison, and I'm joined in the studio today by the distinguished and award-winning writer and literary critic, Stephanie Johnson. Kia ora, Stephanie.
Kia ora, Alison.
Now, in 2019, Stephanie, you were appointed member of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to literature. So congratulations on that.
Well-deserved
honour.
Very special. Thanks.
Yeah, I bet. Now, the critic David Hill wrote in the New Zealand Listener that you are, and I quote, one of the best anatomisers of 21st century Auckland. So when I read this, trust me, I misread it as you being one of the best atomizers of 21st century Auckland. So then I started thinking of you as an atomizer, and I thought of you breaking our lives down into tiny particles and then putting us back together again, or perhaps even distilling our lives down to an essence. And I wondered if this was a good description of what you do.
It's so funny that you say that, because so did I when I read it.
Oh, right.
I thought, what is he on about? I was born in Auckland. I have lived in Auckland nearly all of my life, with only brief periods in Christchurch and in Sydney. And I just write about Auckland because that's what I know. And I feel very comfortable having my characters, you know, traipsing around our streets and beaches and volcanic cones and wherever. I mean, a lot of my books are, as you know, historical novels as well. So, and many of them are set in Auckland too, you know, in the 19th century. And, you know, various parts of the 20th century. Mm. I think Auckland is, I know probably other people outside Auckland may not like me saying this, but I think Auckland is the most kind of exciting city in New Zealand, and probably one of the more exciting cities in the world, actually, because it is so diverse and it is geographically so beautiful.
Yes. Yeah. It is. And that diversity is wonderful, isn't it? Do you know, sometimes I think of us as a big city, but we're also a small town in many respects. So when you write a story that's set in perhaps modern day Auckland, do people ever recognise themselves in the story?
I think when my novel The Writers' Festival was published, various people wanted to see themselves there, but I didn't consciously I mean, you know, I never do that. I mean, sometimes I might have a real person in mind as a kind of springing off point, but I do my darndest to kind of cover my tracks.
Yeah.
And I think writing historical fiction, it's easier. You know, you put someone in a corset or a top hat or whatever, and then they're less likely to recognise themselves. And, you know, for any writer, I suppose, though, it's the grains of truth in that work that make it sing and make it feel real to the reader. So,
yeah. And because I think sometimes we might recognize traits of ourselves in your writing. You know, I'm thinking of the dog walkers from Mount Eden anything like the vegan from Grey Lynn or whatever. Yeah. So you do recognise parts of yourself. But
yes.
Perhaps not.
With Everything Changes, which was my most recent one, the entitled daughter.
Yes.
I hadn't realised just how much of a nerve I was striking there. And in fact, someone told me that they went out and bought another copy for a friend of theirs, who they said to me that this woman's daughter was even worse than Olivia, which I would have thought was almost impossible, actually.
Yes, because Olivia, in the book, so she's the 20-something daughter of the main characters, Davy and Cole, she's almost got a complete absence of moral compass. There's a hilarious scene in it, in the book, where Liv, she does something awful to the poor dog, Mother. But then on the way home, after doing that thing to him, she pops into a cafe in Waipu and has a raw power vegan salad and a kale smoothie. And I thought, that's just classic, isn't it?
Well, she is pregnant. And,
well, that's true.
She is looking after herself. I mean, you know, later in the novel when she's having this sort of rather strange, completely off the wall relationship with that young woman, another young woman, you know, she wants to... She's stolen her mother's credit card, and she wants to be able to have champagne and all, but she knows she can't. You know, she doesn't, particularly having had a disabled brother. You know, she doesn't want. Which I think is a, I think it's a thought that goes through many women's minds when they're pregnant, that they don't want to do anything that they could then feel that it was their fault if the child arrives with problems. You know, so I think, you know, she does. She's not stupid. She's very smart.
That's right. Yes. Yes. It's very, very sad. Now, in so many ways. Now, Stephanie, you're known for your sharp wit and your ability to see the hypocrisies and disconnects in our lives, as we've just been talking about. would you call yourself a satirist?
Well, I've written, I have certainly written satire, and I love writing satire. You know, The Shag Incident was probably most well-known satirical novel. But as we just said earlier, the historical novels, I've written The Whistler, which was a science fiction novel, and then contemporary novels, which often have a kind of element of satire to them. I mean, you can't... I've just read actually a novel by Helen Fitzgerald. I don't know if she was originally Australian, but she's lived in Scotland now for many years, and she writes crime. But they have a slightly satirical element to them. I mean, whether or not you're saying satire or humour, you know, I think humour in contemporary novels is very important. You know, we live in such a bleak world in many respects.
Yes.
And so if we can help people, if readers can laugh at things that otherwise might just make them cry or feel despairing, then that's a great thing.
Yeah, it really is. And in speaking of comedy or things that might make you laugh, they do say that a good comedian should never punch down. They should always punch up. Do you? How would that compare with a writer?
It's funny you should say that. I was watching Ricky Gervais last night, and he says that, and that he talk, and he hates it because he says it's very woke, that idea.
Okay,
And he said, for instance, this is so terrible. I mean, he says if I was to bring a disabled toddler on stage and punch him, well, then I'm punching down.
Yes,
now this is a joke. I'm not actually going to do it. This is just a joke.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not sure about that. You know, I think humour can be found in anywhere. I mean, I was thinking the other day, if you look at British humour, for example, after the Second World War, most of it seemed to be either about Hitler or mothers-in-law. And, you know, I mean, Hitler was a terrifying figure, and perhaps a lot of mothers-in-law are too. But these are the two things the poems were scared of the most, you know. So, I think that, we do live in particularly woke times. We comedians are, I think, probably living through the most difficult period that they ever have. They have to be so careful not to make jokes that can be misinterpreted as racist or sexist, and it's the same for us as people who are putting words down on the page.
Now, getting back to the Writers' Festival, in that book you talk about the writer as a performing pony, and I guess that's kind of a modern thing as well. What do you think about the celebrity culture that now exists in writing and publishing?
I think to a certain extent, the celebrity culture has always existed. I mean, if you look at Dickens, you know, he used to perform and, you know, there were many writers, I mean, not so much women writers, actually, but male writers in previous centuries who would go on tours and have huge audiences. Hugh Walpole, who was a sort of turn of the 19th and 20th century New Zealander who ended up living in England, a gay man, and who was a hugely, hugely famous writer in his time, and he would entertain massive audiences. But yeah, the Writers' Festival, you know, they have become iniquitous. They're everywhere. I think perhaps what worries me now more since I wrote that book is that the number of small regional festivals that are popping up that have access to our very limited arts dollar. And that perhaps, I mean, I'm you know, I do worry about this, that too much of that arts dollar is being put into these festivals rather than supporting individual writers. Because as we all know, it's impossible actually to make a living as a writer in New Zealand. You have to be teaching, you have to be reviewing, you have to have another job.
Also in that book, you talk about, and I'll quote here, it's a bit of a long quote, the parallel universe that exists at the bottom of the world. Books bloom onto the local market and disappear without trace. A few years later, the same topic is addressed by a different writer, either far-flung or local, and presented to the public as if it has no forebears or antecedents. And when I read that, it made me think about why we need really good booksellers like Carol Bew from the Women's Bookshop in Auckland, who holds that sort of memory of books and authors and ideas.
Mm.
And I actually wondered, but I didn't want to be too proud because I was taught not to be, but I wondered also if a good librarian might
librarians
sort of function a bit similarly.
Worth their weight in gold. I love you all.
Thank you.
Maybe I don't love the ones so much that have the complete control of this private collections in certain, not in New Zealand I might add, but sometimes when I've been researching in other countries I've had to do battle with librarians, especially if you've come thousands of miles to see a particular thing, you know, like a ship's journal or something thing that you need to read. Anyway, independent bookstores are just fantastic, and they often reflect the sort of interest and nature of the bookseller himself or herself. And so Carol, you know, for so many years, an absolute darling, you know, has supported women writers. I mean, she sells men as well.
Yes.
But women writers are absolutely her main focus, and women writers from all over the world.
Yes.
And not only does she do that, of course, she runs events.
Yes.
You know, so she was one of the very early, she was involved in the Writers' Festival, the Auckland Writers' Festival from the very beginning, and she knew a lot about how to run these events in the early days, and she's still doing it. She's got Sarah Winman coming in a minute, I'll
say. That's right, yes. Mm. And because she's got a background in theatre too.
And teaching.
Yes.
Which is a kind of performance, you know.
Yes.
So she's a real all-rounder there.
Yeah, and that sort of ties in with that that notion of being the performing pony.
Yes.
But, so you wrote that great piece on her in the book Nine Lives, New Zealand Writers on Notable New Zealanders, and that was published last year. But, so Carol's support for the community, but then the support from the community as well.
Yes,
it's
wonderful. No, she's very loved. And
yes.
I mean, one of the things that I mentioned in that piece on her was that various friends and acquaintances of hers have been asking her, do you have an exit plan? Because she's now in her mid-70s. Mm. But she doesn't at all, and she just wants to keep running her bookstore, which she does with her wonderful staff No, I think she'll be around for many years yet to come, hopefully.
Yes, yes. No, good on her. She's an absolute treasure. Now, I know I keep going back to this one, but in the Writers' Festival, I promise I'll stop soon.
That's all right. It's nice to talk about the book again. Yes. Haven't for a long time.
You say that books are calming, and you describe how, for one of the characters, and I quote, it's as if the deep concentration the writer needed to write the book somehow passes from the pages through her hands and into her body, stilling her anxieties.
Mm.
And I loved that. I loved that sort of, I felt it really described that meditative aspect of picking up a book.
Mm.
And, you know, really you lose yourself in the pages.
And it's not like reading things online or whatever, because nothing can break in. It's just you and the book. And as long as your concentration is holding and somebody doesn't knock on the door or, you know, or drop a bomb on your house or whatever, you know, nothing, you know, if you're you are just lulled into that. Into that world. I mean, it might be a disturbing world. I mean, if you might be reading a you know science fiction novel about a nasty planet, or a book about you know the Second World War or something. But you know, it's just the very act of that deep concentration, which they know now from scanning people's brains while they're reading, is very different to the brain activity even when you're watching a film.
Yes, and they really have found the link between that act of reading and gaining empathy too, which is such wonderful skills.
Yes, because you do absolutely enter into the thoughts and feelings of that character who will hopefully be, you know, I mean, not hopefully, but often and more enrichingly as someone completely different to you.
Yes, it really gets you.
You know, and this
yourself.
Is another thing where we're going to go back to the sort of idea of the woke culture at the moment, where we're supposed to not be writing men if we're women, or women if we're men, or Māori if we're Pākehā, or whatever. I completely reject that, and I will until my dying day. Mm. I just think it is dangerous and stupid.
Mm.
And a denial of who we are as human beings, because as you say, empathy. Through our imaginations, we gain empathy, and through empathy, our imaginations are enriched. They are, it's a cycle.
And quite a virtuous cycle.
Yes. And, you know, I think, you know, to tell us that we can, you know, in old school writing classes, you know, people would be told, you write what you know. That's another idea I absolutely hate. I mean, I've never done a writing class in my life. I mean, I've taught them, but you know, you find out what you know through writing. You find out what you need to know.
What you need to know, yeah. Oh, really interesting. If we jump over to Everything Changes, published last year, a lot of people have said that this has been one of your best books.
That's encouraging.
Yet. Yeah, and it is. It's such a glorious romp of a book, but it does have so many serious messages, and as we were saying before, so much heartache as well. But I think it does look at that that whole concept of books being relaxing, because it follows a middle-aged couple from Mount Eden, Colette and Davy, who buy a dilapidated old motel at the top of the Brindewin Hills north of Auckland, and they plan to turn it into an oasis called Sky Readers Retreat. I did love that part in it where they have an argument, or there's conversation about where do we put the apostrophe in Sky Readers. But with the pregnant daughter who we've talked about, and the misunderstood mutt and mysterious neighbour in tow, and then the paying guests about to arrive at any moment, it's set up to say what could possibly go wrong, and of course just about everything does. But I wondered about this book, if it's almost like a coming of age in middle age.
In middle age.
story.
Well, you do hear of this, don't you, of people wanting, and it's understandable because we don't sort of drop dead at 40 once we've lost all our teeth anymore. You know, we live on. And so, you know, they say that like kids going to school now are likely to have three or more careers through their lives. So that's not what we were taught. We were told, go out, become a nurse, become a teacher, whatever. That's what you're going to do for the rest of your life, you know. So it's another sort of very strong social phenomenon at the moment of people wanting this big change, you know, when they are still really reasonably healthy, not quite at retirement age. And I mean, you must have friends who have done it. I certainly do, where they've left the big smoke, and gone to live in the country, and sometimes it works out, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yes, because I was thinking about that too, that so many Aucklanders do dream of leaving Auckland and either going to the bright
rural little.
Yes, either the bright lights of Sydney or Melbourne or the go rural, go to the beach.
The bright lights you tend to do when you're a bit younger because you're going to need money.
Yes.
You
know?
But whereas if you're one of these loathsome baby boomers and you've struggled to pay off your mortgage, you know, your one little pathetic house you might own, it was like most of us. And, you know, you sell that and go and live in the country, then maybe you've got a bit of money left over, you know, to... I know it's something I will never do. I mean, maybe I was working it through in my own mind, writing everything changes, but even before that, I knew I would want to be... I want to be in Auckland where I have... You know, lots of friends, and there's always something to do.
Yeah,
you know, in terms of just going to a movie or the theatre or going to the art gallery or, you know, meeting someone at a cafe or just going for a walk and people watching.
Yeah,
If I was a keen gardener. And if I hadn't been born with my disability, then maybe I would have lived in the country and had horses and something. I don't know. But that's how my life went.
Yeah. Yeah. And because so much in the book is about navigating change and ambiguity and uncertainty, which I felt was really relevant to our current times, even though I do believe you wrote it before the pandemic.
I did. And so I had to be very careful. When I went back over the proofs, one of the few things I changed was make sure that people understood it was 2018.
It
was all happening. So it was just, you know, just before we got hit. But I've got a novel coming out next April, which I actually sold to Penguin Random last October. So this is COVID that slowed it all down. Mm. But that is set during the first lockdown mostly. So, I think, you know, we've got this... You know, lots of people, of course, lots of writers are dealing with this subject now because it has been such a huge change. It's changed everything. 80% of university students now in Australia study online. That's because of COVID. Mm. And I imagine our figures is probably similar.
Yes, I believe so.
So campus life as we knew it.
Yes.
You know, I don't, you know, I think the way young people socialise has probably changed to, you know, not for all of them, but for numbers of them, just anxiety about, you know, it's a different world. So, of course, we're all going to want to write about it.
Yes, that's right. Now, I wonder if we could briefly have a look at a couple of the characters in Everything Changes, because each one of them I felt had such a distinctive voice. And one of the strongest characters I felt was Choirmaster, the neighbour. I just loved him. He was judged by society, and you make the strong suggestion that he's judged because he's brown, basically. He's on home detention.
He got on the wrong side of the law. But that was because his weirdo mate, who's a Pākehā boy down in Auckland, was using him as a fence to store stolen goods and then also probably dogged him in. I mean, he appears, that ghastly guy, towards the end of the novel, and Choirmaster gets his revenge. But well, we all know, don't we? You know that... we don't need to even talk about it. We,
yes,
you know, we know how.
Some of that's being played out in front of us right now. And, you know, and I feel that you suggest subtly, though, that if he'd been a white boy from a privileged background.
He would have had a good lawyer.
Yes, he'd be in a different position.
Oh, it makes a huge... I mean, I know when my own kids were growing up, different things happened and with some of their mates, and the ones who had wealthy parents and access to, you know, high-class lawyers.
Yeah, it's a different story, isn't it?
Oh, God,
yes.
Yeah, of course it is.
And if I could come to Muzza the dog, I just loved Muzza, and I know that you're a long-time dog lover as well, but he was really judged for his looks as well.
Yes, he ugly bugger.
Yeah, and I imagined him as being a brown dog too.
He's
but
yellow, big yellow dog. Don't you reckon they're the ugliest yellow dogs?
Yeah.
Oh, people who have yellow dogs will defend it.
Yeah, there's one famous one that was called Big Yellow Stupid, I think, by the cat. But yeah, poor Muzza, he didn't have enough poodle in his family history.
No poodle at all, I wouldn't imagine. Oh, who knows?
But he was so loyal and wise and sensitive. But his point of view was, it just broke my heart. When he had done that bad thing that he did, he thought of himself, or he said, guilty, guilty, bad.
Bad. Well, it was quite bad. He killed a cat.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
it is risky starting a novel with a dog's perspective of killing a cat, because there are some people who really love cats and might find that. But, you know, not all dogs, but most dogs, given a chance, will chase a cat. Why not? It's fun.
It was an unfortunate event for him, was it? But I'm sure there's a hashtag there, like hashtag not all dogs, probably. We should do that. But then the way Muzza described the pregnant Liv as girl and pup who makes my coal sad. And that just broke my heart. So he's so observant.
Yes, yeah. Family dogs will be very aware of the kind of dynamics that go on between their humans. And of course he's, you know, had Cole all to himself before, you know, the dreaded Liv reappeared from America.
Yes, that's right. And they're constantly collecting data too, aren't they, when you see them just lying around. Oh, I loved that boy, that Muzza. Do you have any plans for a sequel?
Look, sequels are a very funny thing.
Oh, are they?
No, I'll tell you a secret. Okay, so I wrote the writing class.
Yes. Right.
Then the Writers Festival was a sequel.
Yeah.
Now, I was always intended to write a third one.
Oh.
The Writers Retreat.
Oh.
So what I did was I wrote Everything Changes, and I changed the characters. You know, so it's not the people we knew that were the central characters in the writing class and the Writers' Festival. And also made it not so much a writer's retreat as a reading retreat.
Yes.
And at the time that I wrote that book, there was a little bit around in the media about these places that had opened up. Well, I read about one that was in England anyway, where, you weren't allowed to go online.
Yes.
This was the whole point, that you went to this place, you sat in front of the fire, you went for nice walks, you ate nice food and drank nice wine, and you read books, and you did not, or you might be able to watch telly or something, but you did not go online.
So they were like a digital detox.
Yeah,
really,
digital detox. And it's sort of, I think now, the idea that anyone would even need to do that has sort of gone out the window, because I think now they're so ingrained in our... I think we're still concerned about the effect of it on children. But I think adults, I mean, you know, if you were to step out right now into the Avondale shops, you would just see everyone walking around looking at their bloody phone. I'm amazed when people don't fall over, actually.
Yes, walk into lampposts. So, yes, it's unbelievable.
So that was the, you know, so that was a sequel, actually, in my mind. It wasn't really, but, you know, it was a sort of a sequel, because, the characters in the earlier books didn't have a daughter. They had an old blue heeler, didn't they?
Yes.
Paul Keating, after Paul Keating. I know with some writers, you know, J.K. Rowling accepted Well, sequels are quite hard.
Right. Oh, okay.
Because it's hard to sell, I should say. Because a book buyer might see on the back of the book, I mean, I'm sure you've done it yourself, I certainly have, oh, this is book three. And I think, oh, no, I'm going to read book one. And then you kind of forget about reading book one and you don't.
A lot of our readers in the libraries feel like that too.
You want to start writing at the beginning. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's a good point. Well, I must admit, I can't wait to read what's going to come from you next.
Oh,
so I'm really,
you're so kind, Alice.
Really excited. And I think, sadly, we've just about run out of time. So, look, Stephanie, it's been an absolute honour to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
This has been really fun. I've enjoyed it. So
good.
Take care. We'll see you soon, Stephanie.
You will at the library.